Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the op-ed in today's USA Today by President Trump attacking the Democrats for wanting to expand Medicare to Medicare for All, using the familiar tropes of socialism, big government takeover, and bureaucrats making decisions for you instead of your doctor. Dr. John Guymon, a professor emeritus of family medicine at the Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, whose latest book just out is Trump Care: Lies, Broken Promises, How It Is Failing, and What Should Be Done, joins us. We will discuss how many lies Trump piled into such a short space, which prompted the fact checker Glenn Kessler to write, quote, almost every sentence contained a misleading statement or a falsehood. And since it appears that the Republicans are afraid that Medicare and its expansion is popular and that single-payer health care is becoming increasingly popular amongst younger voters, we will look into the extent to which the Republican sabotage of Medicare and Obamacare is working, with the Republicans being both the arsonists and the fire brigade as they undermine what is working for the American people so that they will be forced to go back to the model that has never worked, a model which has made American healthcare the most expensive in the world with some of the worst results. We will look into the Trump administration's plans to take the healthcare.gov website offline for hours at a time for, quote, maintenance during the upcoming Obamacare enrollment season. Then we'll speak with the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter for The Washington Post, Greg Miller, the author of the new book just out, The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. We'll examine what has been called the political crime of the century and the greatest intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar and sent him to Russia in 1917. Having investigated the Kremlin's covert attempt to destroy Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump win the presidency from before, then during the 2016 campaign right up to the present, with the help of the entire Washington Post national security team, Greg Miller has had face-to-face confrontations with many of the key players, such as Mike Flynn and the former Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak. We will assess where the Mueller inquiry is heading and when the American people will wake up to the possibility that their president is a traitor. And joining us now is John Guymon, a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as chairman of the Department of Family Medicine and is the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises Versus Reality, and What Comes Next, and Crisis in Healthcare, Corporate Power Versus the Common Good. And his latest book is Trump Care: Lies, Broken Promises, How It Is Failing, and What Should Be Done. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Guymon.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And today in the USA Today, there's a remarkable op-ed by President Trump. Remarkable because it's extraordinary to think that you could squeeze so much dishonesty into a small space. And the fact checker, Glenn Kessler, wrote, quote, almost every sentence contains a misleading statement or a falsehood. I imagine you found it to be similarly dishonest.
Absolutely, the whole thing.
So where do we begin?
Well, I've been dealing with this in writing this last book over the last year, which just came out 2 weeks ago or so, and it's up to date to August citations this year, so it's right up to date. And I've been trying to show what all this means since this administration came in and sabotaged the Affordable Care Act to the extent they have. They didn't have a replacement plan. And where we are now is much worse than it's ever been. And my book deals with that in all the facets. On my cover, I have a Trump quote, which is kind of like what's in USA Today. This quote is, we're going to have health insurance for everybody. Buddy, people can expect to have great health care. It will be in a much simplified form, much less expensive, and much better. And I sprinkle through my book all these lies and broken promises. So where to begin? Well, we have a crisis in our health care now, made worse because of the Trump changes, and as they lie, as they do it, but they want to increasingly privatize and deregulate the system we've got, even though we have a largely privatized system that has a lot of fraud in it and a huge amount of waste and is not in patients' best interest. So we have an administrative monstrosity right now with huge amount of waste with 1,300 private insurers who are for profit, of course, and a huge administrative cost, about five times what Medicare for All would be, or a single-payer government financing tied to a private health insurance system. So we've got a huge amount of waste. We have 30 million uninsured now. We have, or 29 million we have, and that's growing. We have 30 million plus underinsured, and we can talk about that. There are lots of ways they're underinsured. We have, the Commonwealth Fund in New York City for years has compared U.S. health care with 10 other civilized countries, Western Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and we come out at the bottom virtually any way you look at it in terms of access to care, cost of care, quality of care, equity or efficiency or anything like that. So with that opener, why don't you ask me what is most important to you, Ian?
Well, I obviously think the op-ed was just a ridiculous piece of propaganda where he's throwing out all of these election campaigning buzzwords, big government takeover, bureaucrats making decisions for you instead of your doctors. It'll cost trillions, socialism, socialism, socialism. We've heard that before. So my sense is that what the Republicans are concerned about in this midterm and what Trump is concerned about is that for the average American, Medicare is extremely popular, and the idea of expanding it to Medicare for All seems like a good idea. And we know that single payer is catching on with the young people who were inspired by Bernie Sanders. So that, to me, is the political reality, is that the American people are waking up to the fact that the current healthcare system we have of private insurance doesn't work, and it doesn't work because there's a simple flaw to it, which is that the insurance companies don't contribute anything. They're like the mafia. Right. They're like the protection racket. They just take money for nothing, that they're an unnecessary layer between the patient and the caregiver. So the logic of single payer is if you pool the money, then you get health care for all, as opposed to have this sickness profit system. It's not health care, it's sickness profit.
It's health care as a commodity, not as a service, and the patient isn't at the center of the focus. It's profits throughout the system, and we know that privatized Medicaid becomes often a racket, a profit-driven racket, and we know the same with privatized Medicare, where the insurers that game the system, they up-code how sick the patients are to get more money, huge amount of fraud throughout all that. So the best study of, number one, back to one of the lies in Trump's thing today is seniors will lose choice. Well, baloney. Seniors will gain choice, and they'll gain better care, as will every other American, including kids. Right now, the private insurers reduce our choice, and we have very unstable insurers. They can change their networks at a moment's notice, and the cost of care outside a network will be huge. They can disenroll you. Medicare Advantage plans will disenroll you if you get too sick. So it's just a rip all the way. But the best study of the economics of single payer in this country is Dr. Jerry Friedman. He's a professor of economics at University of Massachusetts. And he has nailed down what the savings would be right away when we enact Medicare for All, as is in the House bill 676. we would save about $600 billion a year right off, $476 billion of that being savings from prescription drugs, because one thing Medicare for All would do would be to negotiate drug prices with drug companies on a bulk purchasing way, as the VA has done for many, many years, and the VA gets the cost of drugs down to 58% of what you and I pay. So increased choice with Medicare for All right away. I was in practice in Mount Shasta, California in the 60s when Medicare was passed and Medicaid at the same time, 65. And right away, patients would come in with their card. We had no computers then, but it was very easy, the transition. And this would be the same. Every American would have a card.
Again, I'm speaking with John Guymon, a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as chairman of the Department of Family Medicine. And we're talking about the unusual op-ed today in USA Today, supposedly written by President Trump. Never happened before, and I'm actually kind of, I suppose, if the president submits an op-ed, you're going to have to run it. But I wonder why they ran it, frankly, because it's so riven with lies. And as I mentioned, the fact checker Glenn Kessler has noted that nearly every line of President Trump's USA Today op-ed contains a false or misleading statement. So let's figure out now the political battle. We know this is all politics because the Republicans are vulnerable on health care, and they want to kill Medicare and Medicaid, which is popular. They want to kill Social Security, which is popular too, but I guess one battle at a time here, right? So what's your sense of – I'm not very impressed with the Democrats. I was very unimpressed by the way they got rolled by the Republicans in these cabinet hearings. So tell me, what kind of strategies are they offering? Because they've got a popular issue, and they shouldn't be able to drop the ball on this one. What do you know about what they're offering in terms of strategies, and what would you advise as a strategy?
Well, I would advise the Democratic platform in 20, and Democrats running here now in the midterms, to come out strong, as some have and some have not, for single-payer Medicare for All, and not wimp out and say, oh, if we just added a public option, so that would be fine. Well, they did that a few years ago, and it didn't do well. So they ought to get strong and come out clearly for single-payer Medicare for All. The Republicans have no plan. They're very vulnerable. They know they're vulnerable with pre-existing conditions, which they want to have no coverage for pre-existing conditions, and Trump lies about that. He's in trying to protect people with pre-existing conditions. So my advice is to the Democrats, get a strong platform and stick with it, and I think it's a winning platform, but corporate lobbyists will be right there and trying to get them to fall short of that platform. And in a previous book, I nailed down all the contributions on both sides of the aisle, which are in the millions, with the lobbyists getting what they want, pretty much. So right now, with Trump Care, we have the winners are large corporate mergers, private health insurers, the drug industry, corporate CEOs, shareholders, Wall Street, and lobbyists. The losers are patients with pre-existing conditions, chronic illness, women, mentally ill, early retirees, and the elderly, as well as the newly underinsured and uninsured. And Medicaid beneficiaries are getting hurt with cuts, increasing cuts around the country. And physicians and other health professionals aren't happy. More and more are burning out and leaving practice early. Rural hospitals are doing worse. And taxpayers are paying for all this, so it's a mess. So the Democrats have to make that a platform, and they haven't yet.
Well, you mentioned corporate control of healthcare. It's going to get worse by the look of it, because antitrust officials today just gave a green light to CVS pharmacies to purchase Aetna, a big insurance company, in a $69 billion deal. And this is the private sectors. They're touting this as a great new initiative in healthcare. What's your sense? Is it going to free us all and save us money, or is it going to dig the hole deeper for us?
These bigger and bigger mergers and consolidation throughout what we have as a medical industrial complex, it does not save us money. It makes money for the merged corporations, and it reduces choice of us as patients. So it's bad for the system. They gain market share, and it's against patients. But they won't admit it. They will say they're making efficiencies. Well, efficiencies to make more money for themselves.
Well, it looks like in Trump's op-ed in today's USA Today that he's getting his figures from the Mercatus Institute, which is funded by the Koch brothers, saying that...
And that's poor information. It's been discredited already by Drs. Himmelstein and Will Handler, who have written extensively on our system and were for years and were co-founders in 1990 of Physicians for a National Health Program. So that Mercator thing is to be discredited.
The $32.6 trillion figure, I mean, that he claims is going to privatization or the expansion of Medicaid would cost. Bernie Sanders makes the argument that it would save us at least $2 trillion overall. So that's an argument that's got to be clarified, because Trump, of course, is going after Bernie.
Well, the Republicans and the Trump administration are combating this issue by disinformation, by lies, and you just can't believe anything they're saying about that. But the best figures that we have are from Dr. Friedman, and we would save $600 billion a year right off as soon as we enact single-payer Medicare for all. And the winners right off would be all Americans, all physicians and other health professionals. Hospitals will win. They'll be able to have global budgets figured out each year that will be fair. Employers will be no longer burdened by having to cover their employees. Mental health care will get stabilized and become better. Public health will get better. Taxpayers will get much more for what we pay in taxes. Oh, as Friedman tells us, 95% of Americans will pay less for health insurance and health care than we do now. 95%.
Well, the Republicans in the Trump administration, though, are quite venal in their attacks on Obamacare, which they've been very successful at trying to nibble away at it. And, of course, we know that the Supreme Court narrowly kept it alive, but now that Kavanaugh's on the Supreme Court and he hates he's made it clear that he hates Obamacare for whatever reasons I don't understand, but he's going to do what he can to kill it. But they've been sabotaging it all along, but now they're really upping the ante. The Trump administration plans to take the healthcare.gov website offline for hours at a time for maintenance during the upcoming Obamacare enrollment season. So that is just so naked. You know, they really, the Republicans are both the arsonists and the fire brigade. They're destroying what exists of Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare, and then once they've destroyed it, they're going to say, here's your choice. Aetna and CVS and all these other people who obviously won't be constrained in any way with pre-existing conditions, and they'll do what they've always been doing, which is just continually marking up the prices, costing the customer more, because again, they are an unnecessary layer. Their profit and overhead is at the expense of health care for the patient.
That's exactly right. And they're fraudulent in their ideas for what they want to do, like these short-term policies that can last up to 1 year and be renewed for two more years, which don't have to cover any of the essential benefits that was in the Affordable Care Act, which are 10 things ranging from hospitalization and outpatient care to maternity care to mental health, et cetera, et cetera. But these short-term things can maybe offer two of those.
Right.
And
these are the
when
free
people get sick, they think they have insurance, but they don't have any insurance.
Right. These free market packages that they're offering up are completely fraudulent because they may cost you less, but they don't give you anything in terms of, and you know, if you spend the rest of your life reading the fine print. So what's your sense then, Dr. John Guymon, about, I find it extraordinary, for example, that in one of the poorest states in the country, West Virginia, they vote overwhelmingly for Trump. And it's also the state with the worst opioid epidemic per capita. And you see every day in the New York Times a full-page ad by Purdue Pharma telling us how wonderful they are. And they're the ones that started the opioid epidemic and got people hooked on their product. The whole Sackler family ought to be in jail, but they're not. So that's Big Pharma. My sense is that we really are reaching a kind of revolutionary stage in our politics where the baby boomers are aging and the millennials are coming in and they have a very different outlook. And I have a feeling that in spite of all the sabotage from Trump and the mendacity of this ridiculous op-ed that he's put out in USA Today today, that at the end of the day, we're going to end up with single payer sometime, possibly, certainly in the future, but I think possibly in the near future.
Well, my best hope, and I think it's thoroughly possible if we get out the vote, and that's another problem in our supposed democracy, all the gerrymandering and vote suppression. But if we can get a good vote next month, and I almost for sure the Democrats to take the House and hopefully maybe get the Senate. But then all the things the House can do and all the new candidates, including younger candidates and more women candidates, we could actually get Medicare for All in January of 21. That's my best hope.
Well, John Guymon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm glad to be with you, and I share your sense of what's going on and your concern about how important it is. What we have is totally unsustainable, and it's going to become more obvious to a majority of the electorate. It should be now. If we can get around disinformation, it will be. Now.
Well, thank you, John. And again, we've been speaking with John Guymon, a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine. He's the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises versus Reality and What Comes Next, and Crisis in Healthcare, Corporate Power versus the Common Good. And his latest book just out is Trump Care, Lies, Broken Promises, How It Is Failing and What Should Be Done. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter for The Washington Post, Greg Miller, the author of the new book just out, The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy.
I don't give a damn what the doctors say. I ain't gonna spend another lonesome day. I don't wanna die in the hospital. You gotta take me back outside. They don't let you smoke and you can't get drunk. All there is to watch are these soap operas. I don't wanna die in the hospital. You gotta take me back outside. Can you get this tube out of my arm? Morphin' in my blood like a slow sex.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Greg Miller, the national security reporter for The Washington Post, who was among the Post's reporters awarded the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for their groundbreaking stories on Russia's interference in the 2016 elections and the resulting investigations of the Trump campaign and administration. He was also part of the team awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for public service for coverage of America's surveillance programs revealed by Edward Snowden. He's co-author of the book The Interrogators, and his latest book just out is The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Greg Miller.
Thank you very much.
And it seems that a lot of Americans have a hard time getting their heads around the idea that the President of the United States might be a traitor. And we have this peculiar situation where the traditional red baiters and Soviet haters on the right are making excuses for Putin, and many on the left are also making excuses for Putin, like Oliver Stone, the editors of the Nation magazine, Greg Greenwald, etc. So politically, it's a very odd situation, isn't it, where the traditional Russian and Soviet haters are making apologies for Putin, while on the left, you've also got a lot of people hoping that the CIA, who they normally blame for a lot during the Cold War, are now hoping the CIA is going to nail Trump.
You're right. I mean, it's a very disorienting time politically. And it's not just, as you say, the fact that supporters of Trump, the Republican Party, which has always branded itself as the party of sort of national security, is seemingly sort of blasé about Russian interference, and their champion Trump as refuses to even acknowledge that it truly happened. But, you know, the Republicans have always been supporters of our national security institutions, the CIA, the FBI, and others. And those organizations are under enormous pressure from the right right now. I mean, it's not a stretch to say that it is a concerted campaign led by Trump, but also enabled by Republicans in Congress, including Devin Nunes, to discredit the Bureau, to discredit the CIA.
Well, in your book, of course, you have an extraordinary heated moment between the director of the CIA at the time, John Brennan, and the majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, where I believe it was at the time when Obama was trying to get the Republican and Democratic heads of the House and Senate to sign off on a joint statement condemning Russia's interference in the elections, which would have come out in 2016 during the campaign. And the exchange between Brennan and McConnell became pretty heated, and it really sort of highlights what we're talking about, doesn't it? The head of the CIA saying the Russians are interfering, they're going to say something, and for whatever reasons, Mitch McConnell didn't want to go public.
Yeah, no, it's an astonishing moment on many levels, and you're right, it happens in the months leading up to the 2016 election. John Brennan, the CIA director at the time, was holding single one-on-one meetings with the congressional leaders to try to show them what the CIA had learned about the scale and the scope of the Russian interference campaign and impress upon them the seriousness of this threat. And the remarkable thing that happens with McConnell is that, you know, here's Brennan trying to tell him, look, the Russians are meddling in the election. They are trying to throw this election to Donald Trump. We need to try to call them out on it. And McConnell's response is to not only reject that and say, I am absolutely not going to call out Vladimir Putin, but I will call out you. I will accuse the Obama administration of meddling in the election if you try to call attention to what you're describing to me.
So do we have any idea? We have suspicions that Putin's holding something over Trump, but is anybody holding something over McConnell? Or is that just hardball politics?
I think that that's for McConnell. I've never heard anybody suggest seriously that he is, you know, under some sort of influence by Russia. I think this is just absolute hardball politics and a political calculation for him the objective of getting a Republican in the White House in that moment for him mattered more than the security or sanctity of the election.
But that's not to say that there was a meeting, a private meeting of the heads of the House on the Republican side, at which Kevin McCarthy said to Paul Ryan, I swear to God, I think both Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll, at which point apparently Paul Ryan said, you know, sort of, cool it, shut up, let's keep this amongst ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's a telling moment, and it was captured on audio recording that was published by the Washington Post. And I mean, it tells you that even inside the Republican Party, that senior officials are as baffled as others by Donald Trump's behavior toward Putin.
But they're still enabling him, aren't they?
I mean, that's the thing. That's one of the huge themes of the book, The Apprentice, is just, it's, you know, so Trump's behavior, as inexplicable as it is, has been enabled to a large extent by the altered kind of hyper-partisan political climate that we're in here in the United States, where, you know, it wasn't always this way, that that partisan impulses and interests would transcend sort of national security interests. I mean, the idea that in that moment, McConnell, or in other moments, Devin Nunes and others have made that decision, have opted for a sort of the interest of the party over the interest of the country. And of course, Donald Trump does that in an extreme way, where it's more about his interests. I mean, his refusal to acknowledge the reality of Russia's interference is all wrapped up in his own insecurity about having won an election that might have been adversely influenced by an adversary.
Well, we know, Greg Miller, that the first day after he was elected, the first visitor to Trump Tower was the head of the NSA, Admiral Mike Rogers. We also know from your book, The Apprentice, that both the Director of National Security, Dan Coats, and Admiral Mike Rogers, Trump tried to enlist them to push back against the FBI's investigation of his campaign. So what do we know about that initial meeting in Trump Tower the day after Trump's election?
So, I mean, Rogers at the time, when he was head of NSA, was sort of interviewing with Trump for a chance to stay in the job. Of course, Trump's effort to enlist Dan Coats, who's the Director of National Intelligence, Mike Rogers, the head of the National Security Agency, and others to kind of pressure Comey to end the Russia investigation comes later, actually, after Trump is in the White House, in the Oval Office, and has been sworn in as president. But it's, you know, one of many, many troubling moments that are recounted in the book, where Trump is trying to use the inappropriately sort of turn the institutions of government that are supposed to be independent toward his will, and to block this growing investigation that's threatened his presidency.
But 2 weeks prior to that Trump Tower meeting with the head of the NSA, Rogers, along with Clapper, the DNI, and Comey, and Brennan, all on January the 6th of 2017, they all briefed Trump about what the Russians had been up to. They gave him extremely detailed and apparently highly classified information. Comey took him aside for a private briefing about the Steele dossier. I find it highly coincidental that Trump has been on a jihad against those people in those meetings, perhaps with the exception of Rogers. But he's gone after Brennan, he's gone after Comey, and he's gone after Clapper.
Yeah, it's true. They traveled to Trump Tower in early January to present and brief him on the findings of this comprehensive investigation by multiple U.S. intelligence agencies, including the CIA and FBI. And when we read, you know, in the book, I describe that the meeting goes astonishingly well. They're worried as they board their flights up to New York for the meeting that they're going to be kicked out of their conversation before it even gets very far, that because Trump is so volatile and he has already demonstrated that his absolute aversion to this whole area, that they're worried they're going to get kicked out of the room, but they don't. He's sort of friendly with them. But the telling moment comes toward the end of the conversation, where Trump, after having listened to this detailed presentation of highly classified information on what Russia has done, he sort of says, yeah, but it didn't affect the outcome, right? And then he and his advisor sort of huddle, and immediately afterward, instead of asking any questions about, well, what should we do next to make sure this doesn't happen again, they are asking, well, what can we say in a statement? What kind of statement can we put out that will make sure people know that this didn't in any way affect the outcome, this didn't in any way affect Donald Trump's victory?
And then a day, I think it was a day after his inauguration, Trump went to the CIA and made that bizarre speech about the crowd size at the inauguration. Apparently, according to your book, the CIA people were extremely unsettled by it all. And later, in front of the wall of the fallen in the foyer, they started to lay wreaths and flowers. So does that indicate that within the agency, in spite of the fact that Pompeo was there first, and he's obviously quite sycophantic towards Trump, what's your reading on how that community feels about having this president who trashes them, trashes the FBI, undermines the DOJ, and at Helsinki, in front of the whole world after a secret meeting with Putin, he sides with Putin's version that he was innocent, rather than what the intelligence services of the United States had told him about Russia's interference in the 2016 elections and to this day?
Yeah, I think we're living through a moment that would have seemed unfathomable not that long ago. And I think that that's true even for people inside these agencies. And you're talking about a scene that I write about in the prologue for the book, where after he delivers this very self-aggrandizing speech at the CIA on his second day in office, agency employees are so troubled by what they've witnessed, partly because of the setting, right? As you say, it happens in front of this memorial wall, which has dozens of hand-carved stars, each of which designates a CIA operative who's been killed in the line of duty. And here is Trump standing in front of that wall talking about crowd sizes, the number of Time magazine covers he's been on, the size of the inauguration crowd that attends. And they just can't believe that he's so sort of doing this, in this braggadocio that they witness in that setting. They feel so that the site is desecrated in such a way that people start bringing flowers and laying them at the base of the wall in the ensuing week. I mean, I think that those agencies none of these agencies have any choice. They've had to adapt to this situation, and they are doing their best to continue going about their jobs of gathering intelligence and engaging in analysis and so forth. But I think that scene sort of tells you the depth of the concern in some parts of the intelligence community about this period that we're living through.
Well, it's an extraordinary, again, for the whole world watching that display after the secret meeting in Helsinki of the deference that Trump showed towards Putin. It prompted the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, to say that he thought it was nothing short of treasonous, and he made the case that any normal American president, knowing what he knew about what Russia had done, would have taken that opportunity to turn to Putin and look him in the eye and say, yes, you did it, and don't do it again. So what explains the fact that we don't have a normal American president? That gets to the heart of The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the subversion of American democracy. And you can't answer that question, I guess, Greg. I can't answer it, but you've come awfully close in The Apprentice.
I mean, I think that you're right. It's like it is still a bit of a mystery, but it's even odder given how Trump himself would presumably stand to gain. I mean, this was a absolutely squandered opportunity for him as a political figure and as a president for posterity, right? I was there in that meeting in Helsinki. I was there for that briefing in the palace in Helsinki and watching Trump standing next to Putin. And he gets this question, right? Mr. President, can you turn to the Russian leader and warn him not to ever engage in anything like this again? And Trump can't do it. And it's at a time where if he had done so, if he somehow could have summoned the will or the way to turn and say, you know, listen, Mr. President, I know that you deny you interfered in the U.S. election, but my intelligence services have categorical proof that you've done so, and it's just, I'm here to tell you that that will not be tolerated going forward. I mean, it would have really transformed the way we view Trump as a person and as a president. And so it's all the more baffling that he can't even do it when he stands to gain so much from taking a step like that. And it does raise this really haunting question about, well, what accounts for that? And I think that, you know, you're right, there is no simple, clear answer. There have been lots of theories. Perhaps there's some compromise, photos of Trump with prostitutes in the Ritz-Carlton or something like that. That may prove to be true, but we've not seen any corroboration of that so far. And I think that Robert Mueller and his investigation, I think we stand to learn a great deal about the extent of any Trump organization financial connections to Moscow that may help illuminate this issue. But, you know, a part of it is just staring at us right in plain sight. It is that Trump sees Putin as a model, right? That's why I called the book The Apprentice. In some ways, he is sort of an apprentice to Putin in that he seeks to emulate him and sees him as the sort of leader with the sort of powers that he wishes that he had.
Well, that's what I understand that came out of that meeting that he had in the Nobu restaurant in November of 2013 when he tried to meet with Putin. And instead, as a consolation prize, Putin sent over all the top oligarchs. And, of course, they're all incredible billionaires, and Trump is a wannabe billionaire. And these guys have got so much wealth and power that if a woman turns up dead in their bed, she disappears. It seems like Trump bought into their worldview. What do you think?
I don't know that he envies that power specifically or that sort of situation, but it's clear that when he looks to Putin and sees a leader who doesn't have to deal with the problems that he has to endure as president of the United States. I mean, Putin doesn't have to deal with a Mueller investigation or any investigation, right? The corruption that exists in Russia goes unchecked, and those who dare to challenge it risk their lives in doing so. The critics of the Russian president often end up dead or disfigured. There is no really meaningful political opposition to Putin in Russia, or much criticism in the press, frankly. So, I mean, these are all things that just if you listen to Trump and take him at his word, you would have to conclude that he wishes that he had a similar arrangement as president of the United States.
Well, is that to say that he wants to loot the United States as Putin has looted Russia? I mean, Putin's whole, the reason he's brought in sort of fascist tactics and anti-democratic tactics and control the press and the judiciary and frames people and murders people, at the end of the day, he doesn't want the Russian people to know that he's stealing the country blind, or him and his cronies are.
Although I think that Russia experts would argue that for Putin, he clearly has enriched himself and is there hidden bank accounts going with God knows how much money in them. But that for Putin, power is more important than accumulated wealth. And the way he consolidates power in Russia is through these financial arrangements and the corruption that in which he sort of enlists and enables these oligarchs around him to sort of act on his behalf, and their payment for doing so is the riches that they get from controlling these sources of wealth in Russia.
Well, you have a great scene in your book, The Apprentice, Greg Miller, where you personally confront Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador who is now being recalled. Tell us about that.
Yes, that was really an interesting moment. There are parts of the book where I write about events inside the Washington Post as we were breaking all of these stories about Russia, about Trump, and in the early days of the investigation, and that was one of them. So it was at a time when we were trying to figure out, we knew that Mike Flynn, the Trump's first national security advisor, had a secret conversation with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, in late December, right on the same day or the day after President Obama announced a bunch of sanctions to punish Russia for its interference in the election. Russia didn't retaliate. I mean, it was almost inexplicable and hard to understand. Russia always retaliates. There's always, throughout the history of the Cold War and then post-Cold War, U.S.-Russia relations, kind of retaliatory interactions between the United States and Russia. And Putin holds off in this case. So why does that happen? I mean, and all of those questions center on Flynn. We're not getting straight answers from the White House. So I saw one day that Kislyak was going to be speaking at a science conference, of all things, in Washington at a hotel up Connecticut Avenue. He's a trained physicist and was speaking at a conference of physicists. And so I pulled up there and got into a front row seat, just hoping to sort of watch him and follow him out the door after he left. But he stunned me and came back and sat down right beside me. He didn't know who I was, but now he was sort of stuck sitting next to me for the rest of this event. And I used it. I identified myself as a reporter for the Post and started asking him questions about Flynn. And right away, he acknowledged that he had a long-standing relationship with Flynn, many, many conversations with the guy. He wouldn't tell me whether they had discussed sanctions. So that was not where we learned that that, in fact, had happened. But it was one of those moments that helped us get there and helped us get to that story that ultimately led to Flynn's resignation.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment, resuming the conversation with Greg Miller. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'm continuing the conversation with Greg Miller, a national security reporter for The Washington Post, who was among the Post reporters awarded the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for their groundbreaking stories on Russia's interference in the 2016 election and the resulting investigations of the Trump campaign and administration. He was also part of the team that was awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for public service for coverage of American surveillance programs revealed by Edward Snowden. And he's the co-author of The Interrogators, and his latest book just out is The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. And, Greg, I've often said that Putin's operation to subvert the American elections and perhaps elect Donald Trump, even though perhaps they didn't think it would happen, but nevertheless, either way, they were going to be beneficiaries. If Trump had lost, he'd be going around the country saying, lock her up, and he would be diminishing Hillary Clinton's ability to govern. So that seems to be a win-win for Putin. But I think in an historical context, it's probably the greatest intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sent him to Russia. What do you think?
It's an astonishing operation, and partly a sort of the return on investment ratio in this is part of what makes it so amazing. I mean, you're right. The level of sort of dysfunction and discord in the United States, we can't lay all of that. We can't blame all of that on Putin, or even most of it, I think. A lot of it is on us. But boy, Russia exploited divisions, existing divisions in our country, to an astonishing degree. Used our own technology, companies that are among the sort of shining lights of American industry, Facebook and Twitter, and turned them against us in a way that has just sown so much destabilization in the United States, and it lingers even now. And Trump compounds all that, right? They end up getting more even than they bargained for, because his conduct as president, his sort of seeming mind meld with Putin on many key issues, including the denigration of NATO and important American alliances, are just sort of keep reaping dividends for Russia from this operation.
Well, it is extraordinary that democracies around the world are under assault, as they are here at home. And what Putin is doing is a concerted effort to undermine democracy. That is his MO. He makes no bones about it. That's what he's doing. And I guess it's a sort of part of this hybrid warfare that he's operating, where you can subvert and bring down or damage democratic governments and institutions without firing a shot.
Yeah, to deliver an enormous black eye to American-style democracy. The meddling also happens in other democracies around the world. We're really living through an era in which we're seeing a new and unprecedented level of aggression from Russia in terms of espionage, because it's much broader, really. I mean, the interference in the election is part of a much bigger effort by Putin to exert power and influence around the world through sort of covert or illicit means. We just learned this past week that Russian operatives had been trying to hack anti-doping agencies that had expelled Russia from Olympic competitions. We've seen Russia carry out assassination attempts in Salisbury, England, and elsewhere. And there's, because, you know, partly because of how Trump responds to this, it contributes to a climate of relative impunity because, you know, Putin does not have to worry about being called out for any of this by the American president. And that's very, very different than at any other time in our recent history, regardless of which party holds the White House.
What I find extraordinary about your book, Greg, The Apprentice, is how it condenses or gets its hands around this incredibly complicated story with all these tentacles. This incredible Russian operation had all kinds of layers, and it seemed there was a lot of redundancy. And I mean, just one person who was sitting at that table, for example, in December of 2016 at the 10th anniversary of RT, you've got Michael Flynn, who's a big character in your book. You reveal an awful lot about what I assume Mueller has on him. You've got Jill Stein of the Green Party, and you've also got Julian Assange's father. Jill Stein took enough votes away from Hillary Clinton in those three key states that Trump won narrowly to get him over the top. I'm not suggesting that she may well have been what the Russians called a useful idiot, but it was nevertheless a factor.
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked this. So, I mean, this wasn't a part of the reason for writing this book. This is a sprawling story, and it's an important one. It's a violation of a key part of American democracy. And I think we're going to be looking back on this period in history for years and years and years to come. But it was such a complicated story that even those of us who were covering it struggled to comprehend it while we were in the middle of it. Right, we would see stories break, we would break stories ourselves, and be unable to see the broader context of other events that were happening simultaneously. You would learn things in bits and pieces and out of sequence. And so I thought it was important to try to put it all together in a way that would enable readers to understand this narrative, right, and put it from the beginning to the end, or at least until this point of the story. And in doing it, one of the most amazing things to me was just sort of in laying out a chronology and a timeline, seeing connections that didn't appear obvious at the time or were impossible to make at the time. And I'll give you just one example, right? We all remember that moment in the election where Trump stuns everybody and says, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you'll go and find those missing Hillary emails. It wasn't until Robert Mueller's indictment of Russian intelligence service and their operatives did we learn that, in fact, Russia was listening and within hours had launched spear phishing operations to try to get at Hillary Clinton's emails and inside her computer networks. There were connections like that over and over again that weren't obvious or clear at the time that I was able to lay out in the book, and I think that make a lot more sense when you read it.
Well, what's extraordinary is that, you know, you mentioned Facebook. In October 2012, Mark Zuckerberg met with Dmitry Medvedev, the Prime Minister of Russia, at the Gorky House and asked him about how Facebook influenced the 2012 elections. Now, I'm not accusing Zuckerberg of being a useful idiot, but they certainly, the Russians seemed to understand the value of Facebook very early, wouldn't you say?
They did, and Facebook was painfully slow to realize just how vulnerable its network was to manipulation by an adversary as sophisticated as Russia. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book where I talk about this this entity called the Internet Research Agency. It's this sort of plain-sounding thing in St. Petersburg, a building where people would show up to work each and every day to pump propaganda and falsehoods and fake information and divisive information into Facebook and into Twitter for American audiences. Employees, this was all bankrolled by the Kremlin, and workers would show up. They would watch things like House of Cards on Netflix to sort of practice at getting the American language and idioms down and vernacular, and use that to try to create phony identities that would then try to divide people over things like immigration, about the Black Lives Matter movement. They used it to spread disinformation about Hillary Clinton and her supposedly grave health issues and things like that. And, I mean, it took a long time. Only long after the election was over was there any sort of meaningful reckoning for Facebook in coming to terms with just how badly its platform had been exploited.
Just as we wrap up, Greg, I wanted to point out that, what your book, The Apprentice, does is how early this whole operation began, because the hack by Guccifer that turned out to be the GRU, Russian military intelligence, that revealed, Guccifer hacked into Sidney Blumenthal's private account, and therefore they were able to find that Hillary Clinton had a private server at her residence in upstate New York. And that, as we all know, haunted her throughout the entire campaign. So this is what I find so incredibly valuable about The Apprentice, is that it gives you a kind of timeline of how this whole thing unfolded. And you've got amazing stuff, and including the fact that enveloped arrived at the Washington Post with some extremely explosive information. So just in the last minute or so, Greg, maybe you can add to those reasons that seem obvious to me.
Well, I would just say that I hope your readers understand it isn't just about the election and the interference in the election. It carries you right through deep into the Trump presidency and Trump's behavior and continued behavior toward Russia and toward Vladimir Putin. And it's written as much as I could do it as a novel, right? It's almost like a novel or a screenplay in terms of the detail I try to bring, describing scenes inside the White House, inside the Justice Department, even inside Facebook, or as I just mentioned, the Internet Research Agency. I'm trying to connect you to the characters that are most important in this story and give you vivid, vivid details about these moments that I think are hugely consequential for the United States, for our version of democracy, and for Western democracy.
Well, Greg Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we've been speaking with Greg Miller, the National Security Reporter for The Washington Post, who was among the Post reporters awarded the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Investigative Reporting for their groundbreaking stories on Russia's interference in the 2016 election and the resulting investigations of the Trump campaign and administration. He was also part of the team awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for coverage of American surveillance programs revealed by Edward Snowden. And he's the co-author of The Interrogators, and his latest book just out is The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.